The views and opinions expressed on America's Workforce Union podcast and its digital media channels are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of the producers or sponsors.
Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Medical residents in Northern California moving one step closer to unionizing. The fifth Trader Joe's files for a union election, and today on the show, the Smart Transportation Division on rail safety, and labor lawyer Andrew Strom. Welcome to the Friday, April 12th edition of America's Workforce, where we're available on at least five platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and Pandora. We have two guests on the show today. We're going to start things off with a newcomer, another newcomer to America's Workforce, and that would be Jared Cassidy. Jared currently serves as the alternate national legislative director for the Smart Transportation Division, which, by the way, is comprised of about 125,000 active and retired members who work in a variety of different crafts in the transportation industry. And once again, SMART stands for sheet metal, air, rail, and transportation. And they merged all those unions, oh my gosh, at least a dozen years ago. In addition to his elected roles, Jared has also been appointed as the union's chief of safety. And we're going to talk a whole lot about rail safety today, or the lack thereof. He serves as the director for the Smart TD National Safety Team, which, by the way, assists the National Transportation Safety Board in major rail-related accident investigations. Very important role there. Also, Jared is the first labor member, the first to ever be appointed to the Transportation Security Administration Surface Transportation Safety Advisory Committee. Guy's got a lot of credentials, and he is going to talk, number one, about the two-person crews. And we talked about this several times on the show. This was about 2 weeks ago. The Biden administration required the largest freight railroads to operate their trains with at least two people on board. Some of these trains today are 4 miles long. Can you imagine a train 4 miles long with one person controlling it? That's what the industry wants, and they're still going to fight for it, believe me. So we'll talk about the Railway Safety Act, which, according to some, and Jared's going to talk more about this, is getting closer to approval in the Senate. Now, we got the House. That's a whole different story. So we'll get into all of that and more with Jared Cassidy as our first guest. Our second guest on the show is Andrew Strom. He has become our regular labor lawyer, and we started this segment with Joyce Goldstein some years ago. And Joyce has since become the general counsel for the bricklayers and allied craft workers, so she's been kind of busy. And Andrew has been picking up some of the slack here. And one of the cases he's going to talk about is Starbucks versus McKinney. And the Supreme Court is apparently going to hear this case, where Starbucks, joined by the usual assortment of corporate interest groups, is trying to make it harder for the labor board to obtain preliminary injunctions against employers. Now, that's one. The other involves a number of Republican-led states trying to discourage private employers from reaching card check agreements with unions. Now, Tennessee already passed a law, this happened last year, prohibiting any recipient of state economic development incentives, like subsidies for creating jobs, from voluntarily recognize a union on the basis of authorization cards, better known as card check. Georgia has passed it. I don't know if the governor has signed it yet. And a couple of days ago, we talked to Adam Keller, the Valley Labor Report, on this very issue. And Alabama has introduced legislation to do the same thing. So anything to beat down unions. Anything to beat down unions. So Andrew Strom will be our second guest right here on America's Workforce. Now, a brief look into the world of labor. This segment brought to you by Boyd Watterson Asset Management. You can find more at BoydWatterson.com. Hundreds of medical residents and fellows at Kaiser Foundation Hospitals, this would be in Northern California, are formalizing their efforts to unionize. Representatives from the Committee of Interns and Residents, CIR, filed paperwork with the Labor Board that would kick off a union certification vote. Medical residency is notoriously demanding and low paid. Doctors working about 80 hours a week, making $60,000, maybe $80,000 a year in the Bay Area, which is a pricey place to live. If the unionization efforts succeed, CIR would represent about 500 Kaiser residents and fellows at hospitals in San Francisco, Oakland, San Jose, and several other Northern California locations. Now, this effort is the latest in a nationwide trend of young physicians pushing their employers for better benefits, better pay, and certainly better working conditions. Trader Joe's United, that's the union trying to organize a number of Trader Joe's around the country. They have filed for an election at a store in Chicago, which would become the fifth Trader Joe's location to unionize if the union prevails. Workers say they are organizing to win better wages and benefits as well as more clarity about career advancement. Now, it was reported several times that the NLRB has charged the company with unfair labor practices in response to organizing efforts across the country, including threats, interrogation, and retaliatory discharge. The grocer also attempted to sue the union for trademark infringement based on the similarities between the store's logo and the union's logo. Now, the judge dismissed the suit, saying that Trader Joe's came dangerously close to deserving sanctions for a frivolous lawsuit. And the company, well, they're not taking that lightly. They are appealing that. And one more here. Starbucks Workers United and Starbucks have set a date for a bargaining session with delegates from 400 unionized stores. That's a number they're up to right now. Those talks will begin in a couple of weeks. The announcement marks yet another step closer to a contract after the company refused to negotiate for years with its workers. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jared Cassidy, on behalf of the Smart Transportation Division, talking about rail safety right after this.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Are you looking for a new healthcare partner for your union members? Let Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield be your champion, making sure your members live their healthiest lives now more than ever. It's important to have a partner you can trust, one who understands the unique challenges unions face. Anthem provides a variety of options to meet your organization's needs and helps you control costs without sacrificing quality of care. For more information, visit anthem.com/labor and trust. America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the United Steelworkers. You can find more at usw.org.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at boydwatterson.com.
The Iron Workers Great Lakes District Council, consisting of 8 iron worker local unions in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Michigan. We build the skylines and bridges along the Great Lakes. With more work than ever before, the Great Lakes District Council is actively searching out the next great iron worker. Whether it's building the next Intel plant or constructing a bridge to safely connect our great cities along the lake. So join the Iron Workers Great Lakes District Council today. Find out how and learn more about the council by visiting iwdistrictcouncil.com. America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America. You can find more at cwa-union.org.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
America's Workforce is presented by the Labor's International Union of North America. Feel the power right now at liuna.org.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook or follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. That would be AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the North Coast Labor Federation. Let's go to line number one. Welcome a newcomer to the show. His name is Jared Cassidy. And Jared currently serves as the alternate national legislative director for the Smart Transportation Division, that sheet metal, air, rail, and transit. And that's comprised of approximately 125,000 active and retired members who work in a variety of different crafts in the transportation industry. And the big story, and this is big, two-person crews. And this has been a fight, and Jared's going to talk about that. But first, Jared, talk to me a little bit about your background, getting involved in the rail industry, which has been the focus of a whole lot of attention. And you know that all too well. We record this show in Iron Workers Local 17 in Cleveland, Ohio, which is not too far from East Palestine, Ohio. And that's a story in itself. And that kind of put rail safety on the front page, and hopefully we're going to get some movement on that bill. From what I understand, it's been kind of slow. But welcome to America's Workforce. Talk to me how you got involved in this industry. Go ahead.
Sure. First, thanks for having me. I started back in 2005 with CSX as a conductor. 2008, I promoted to a locomotive engineer. But early on in my career, I learned real quickly what being railroaded actually means. And my second trip ever to climb on a locomotive, I was going down the road, make a very long story short, ended up getting written up as a trainee for not holding my promoted crew, who was responsible for my training, accountable. And so I learned real fast what the harassment and intimidation, or the harassing and intimidating environment, is like in the railroad industry. And lo and behold, that repeated itself during my training. And then I experienced the worst of the worst when it comes to safety issues. And I thought, well, I'm going to start getting involved. And so my local chairman, who's our local steward, if you will, kind of took an interest in me very early on, about 6 months into my career, and asked if I'd be willing to help and assist him. And so I was elected to a vice local chairman position. Next thing I know, 6-8 months later, he had to have open heart surgery, and I found myself serving as the local chairperson, and kind of away we went. I had a terrible accident occur for one of the guys that I represented that lost his life. I was on duty and had the very unfortunate displeasure of hearing it on the radio, and that changed my trajectory a second time and kind of put me on a full-bore safety mission as well as a union mission. And so I did the local stuff. I was elected to an assistant general chairperson position, which is kind of responsible for a territory, if you will, in the railroad industry. It's the former railroad property. So for us, it was the CNO. And then I was elected to the state legislative director of Kentucky in 2012. And then, as you stated, in 2019, I was elected to this position, which is an international position.
You're serving, I see, as alternate national legislative director and also chief of safety. You said something that really caught my attention, and you said it so well. You were railroaded by the railroad industry. I have to ask you, and I've heard a lot of horror stories in a number of the podcasts that we've done over the years. Why is that? I mean, it sounds like all the workers there are treated like crap. I mean, look what they had to go through to get sick leave. It was ridiculous. But why? I guess there's a history of that in the industry. Is that right?
Since day one, the best I can tell. I mean, it defies logic. And when you're working out there, you experience it. But to put it into words in a way that's representative of what all rail workers experience is a very difficult, if not impossible, task. You know, why they do it, I don't know. I mean, personally, it almost feels like a lack of interest in doing it the right way. And I think they believe it's easier just to harass and intimidate people to keep them under their thumb. And if they're not happy and they leave or they get fired, so be it. Because the railroad industry for generations has been the premier labor job. And there was never a loss of interest for workers for the railroads. And that's now changing because it's become so bad. You know, but to answer why they do it, I wish I could get in their head and tell you that, but I don't understand. I mean, management does not make sound decisions. They don't make safe decisions. You know, the pressure from the top, it just keeps feeding its way to the bottom. And that middle level of management doesn't know how to cope with that. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. it results in just the browbeating of their workers.
And I noted that over the years, a lot of these rail companies have been taken over by Wall Street or hedge funds. And that I can only assume that has made it worse, because you're dealing with these money managers who really, I don't think they know very much about the industry itself. You feel the same way?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, they come in, they show their interest, they see a quick profit. And basically it's to cut all the resources, to cut all the workers, to try to drive that maximum profit. It's basically like bleeding a turnip. You know, you keep doing as much as you can to get as much profit out of it, but really have no interest in serving your customers. You really have no interest in the genuine qualities that a business should possess to make itself successful. And rather, this is just a gut it all and get as much as you can out of it and then run away when the time is done.
Yeah.
And right now we find ourselves in the middle of gutting it and trying to get all that money out of it. And I mean, you're watching it play out on Norfolk Southern. You know, I will say, yeah, since East Palestine, you know, they have made some positive changes, and now Ancor is wanting to come in and they don't like it. You know, safety does cost a little money sometimes, but they're still making billions of dollars on each quarter. And so there's no rationale in cutting the safety aspect out of it. But to your point, Wall Street is greedy. They want everything they can get. And safety is a cost that's not warranted, in their opinion. And away we go.
Yeah, you mentioned that, Ancora. We talked about that with Greg Regan from the Transportation Trades Department, and apparently they got a campaign going on to save the CEO. Greg said, "Yeah, I can't believe in my life that I'm trying to save a CEO, but they have to keep the guy that they have now, because this company that wants to take him over is going to put somebody in there that's even worse." So it's just ridiculous what's going on. You know what? I want to get into the Railway Safety Act, but first and foremost, we got to talk about this monumental move here by the Biden administration on two-person crews. And I know the industry is not happy about it. Jared, walk me back on this. I know this was a long-running campaign by a number of unions. There's like 12, 13 unions involved in rail. Maybe give us a little history on this, on how difficult this was to accomplish.
Sure. Our president, Jeremy Ferguson, was with Secretary Buttigieg when he announced the rule. And President Ferguson, in my opinion, said it right. Last Tuesday was a monumental day for rail workers. And, you know, we've been fighting this fight since 2011, 10, somewhere in there. You know, and basically the need for it was born out of the greed of the railroads. Once again, we're having the same kind of conversation. They're looking at ways to cut expenses or liability, which the most expensive is always going to be your payroll. And so they found interest in cutting crew size or crew staffing, which is only at two people. You know, you have trains now that are pushing 4 miles long in the United States of America, and there's only two people on it. But they're wanting to go to one, and they expressed that interest, you know, as I said, back years ago. And so we, in return, decided to start pursuing legislation that would protect the minimum crew size standard. And there's been a history of accidents along that whole effort, if you will, that kind of coincide with it. And one of the most pivotal is the Loch Megannock in Canada accident, where a crude oil train staffed by one person basically ran away and blew up a town and killed 47 people, injured. I don't even remember how many were injured, but it basically wiped an entire city off of the map. And Canada, in return or in response, said, we're going to make a two-person crew law. Mm-hmm. And FRA the Federal Railroad Administration and the Obama administration recognized that and said, we're going to do the same thing because clearly this is an issue. That train was bound for America. It was only a dozen miles or so away from the American border. It could have very well happened in Maine as it did in Canada. And so they started the effort. And then, unfortunately, it took too long. The White House changed. And when that happens, bad things come along with it. And surely enough, the FRA administrator in Ron Vettori, who was a former railroad CEO that was appointed by President Trump to head the FRA, came in and said, no, we don't want that, and just pulled the rug right from under our feet without any justification. Ironically, his excuse or justification on why he pulled the rug out from under our feet was based on the lack of data or the fact that there is no data. And basically was willing to take all the risk. You know, he couldn't make the argument that one person is safer than two persons. But ironically, he said, since we have two people on every train, we don't know what the data actually is if we were to go to one. So we can't prove anything. He's trying to prove a negative, in essence, and pulled the rule out from under our feet. And then thankfully, President Biden comes into office. We get a new administrator who actually prioritizes safety and saw the need for this rule, and here we are today.
So we have the rule in place as we speak, two-person crews and trains that are almost 4 miles long, if not that already. I'm kind of scared about the industry here. What can they do? And I'm reading a comment here from Ian Jeffries, who's the president of the Association of American Railroads. He says the FRA, the Federal Railroad Administration, is doubling down on an unfounded and unnecessary regulation that has no proven connection to rail safety. You know, these groups have a whole lot of money. What can they do here? And I guess a different administration can turn this around then as well? Is that what the case may be?
Theoretically, yes. And so, you know, to his point, I want to go on record here as saying this. What he's saying is kind of an asinine notion, because the fact is there's been two-person crews in this country since 1985. And we are at the safest, richest era of railroading ever in the history of the railroad industry in America. And that has been born and brought by the two-person crew. And for them to say that there's no safety data or anything of that nature is not true, because everything that we have today is because of the two-person crew. But the unfortunate reality of this is all of the success stories, all of the accidents that are prevented, all of the things that didn't happen because of the second person in the crew is not recorded or captured or reported in any capacity by the railroads to anyone. And so it's this blank shadow, or it's this mystery of what's going on out there. And it's purposeful by the railroads because it gives them the strength to say what Ian is saying in that statement. There's no data. Well, there's no data because they purposefully choose not to collect it. Yet I'm telling you, every single day, accidents are prevented because of the second person in the cab of the locomotive. Mm-hmm. You know, but where are we headed? What are we doing? What are we up against? I mean, we're up against a monster here. And could the next administration come in and pull that out from us too? I believe so. But because it's already a rule that's made now, you at least have to go through the formal processes to make that happen. Aside from an executive order, I would assume. I don't know if an EO has that power or not, but, you know, theoretically they would have to go in and they would have to do all the notices, all the comments, all the public input, things of that nature. But does the next administration scare us? Yes, it does. And this is a perfect example of why elections matter.
Jared Cassidy joining us in our live line today. Jared serves as the alternate national legislative director for the Smart Transportation Division. Also, he serves as chief of safety, and safety is paramount. We're going to talk about that next with the Railway Safety Act. Is that going anywhere? We'll find out from Jared. Back in a few minutes.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes La Una to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Founded in 1887, the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees Division of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters represents the employees responsible for tirelessly constructing and maintaining the national rail system in America. For more than a century, the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees has proven they have what it takes to protect its members and meet the ever-changing challenges of the rail industry. Today, the BMWED continues to fight for job security, fair wages, better benefits, and safer, more modern work environments. For more information, please visit BMWE.org. America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, where you can find more at teamster.org.
Union members need to be heard. Reliable and convenient union voting has never been more important than it is now. Make voting easy for your membership by working with survey and ballot systems. SBS offers encrypted and monitored solutions that ensure your elections are accurate and accessible for every member through mail-in, online, and in-person voting. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com and take the next step in getting secure and auditable elections.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the International Federation of Professional and Technical Engineers. You can find more at ifpte.org.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy,
and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the Heat and Frost Insulators Labor Management Cooperative Trust. Find out more at insulators.org/LMCT.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferentz with America's Workforce.
And remember, you can check us out on at least five platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and Pandora. And when you get an opportunity, here's what you do. Just sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis and give us a rating. We always appreciate those five-star ratings, so please keep them coming. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oh.aft.org. In fact, we'll be checking in with Melissa Cropper on behalf of the Ohio Federation next Tuesday. Right now, though, let's rejoin Jared Cassidy. Jared is the alternate national legislative director for the Smart Transportation Union. Also, he serves as chief of safety, and safety is paramount in all jobs. But we're talking about the dangerous conditions on the rails. Mr. Cassidy, let's talk about this Railway Safety Act, and we've done several shows on it. From what I've been gathering, maybe you could fill in the blanks here. I guess there's some good parts. There's some parts that could be improved, like any legislation. My concern is it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. Can you fill us in? Where do we stand on this, sir?
Yeah, so fingers crossed. It sounds like the bill is going to come to the Senate floor sometime next month. To be fair and to be transparent to all of your listeners, we've heard next month before. So I say that a little hesitantly, but it does sound like it's coming to the floor next month, June at the latest, and hopefully we'll see some action on it. The fear, of course, is this is an election year, so you know our politicians, unfortunately, are going to kind of be seeing the priority of running their own races, and time is getting short. But like I said, fingers crossed, hopefully next month, June at the latest.
Now, I know this came forward because of what happened in East Palestine in February of 2023. You've been in the industry for a while. You've been involved in the union. You've been lobbying for a quite amount of time. And I'm sure you've looked over the components of this. How do we look right now, in your opinion?
We look better than we've looked in a long time. I mean, you said it. It's not a perfect bill. I don't know that there ever will be a perfect bill, and this is certainly not one of them. But it does have a lot of critical safety or critical safe components that we've asked for and that were also evident as a result of East Palestine. And so it has the crew size issue in there. You know, what we have now is a regulation. We as a union very much want and need this to become law, so we have that backstop, and the Rail Safety Act does that. On the flip side, do you have some hazardous material stuff that goes along or that also fits in there? Much overdue, much needed. I think there's some room for improvement in it, but that being said, it's a good starting point, and it's certainly something we're supportive of. You got wayside detectors. The defect detectors, as we call them, are really important pieces of the rail industry. And what you do is you rely on them to kind of give you an update on what the integrity of your train is. And unfortunately, there's no regulation, there's no rule, there's no law that requires them. And therefore, there's nothing that talks about what the standards are for those devices. And so they vary across all of the carriers. And in East Palestine, what was happening because of the Wall Street and the greed that had taken over Norfolk Southern is they had turned those devices off, or not necessarily off, they silenced them or muted them. And so the crews weren't aware of what was actually going on with their trains. And like in East Palestine, there were defects that were actually happening as they were going down the rail and making their trip. But instead of like in your car, if the check engine light were to come on and tell you there's a problem, that wasn't happening for the crews. What was happening is that notification was going to some back room with a manager sitting in it in Atlanta, Georgia. And then they were making the decision of whether or not to tell the crew if they should stop the train. And it's just a completely bonkers notion of how you run that. So the Rail Safety Act is working to fix that. You've got some stuff in there about train length, which is absolutely critical at this point in this country, because the links are growing to astronomical amounts of distances. And then you've got some stuff in there about first responders, which is really needed. The training piece, the money piece, but then also how they're notified of the commodities going through communities. And that also is desperately needed.
Would you say if this Railway Safety Act was to be law, like last year, that East Palestine probably wouldn't happen if they abided by the law, that is, of course. But in your opinion, if we had this legislation, that perhaps may not have happened?
Without a doubt. Shortest answer you'll get from me all day, without a doubt.
You nailed it. Okay, another question here. I know the rail lobby is fighting this tooth and nail. What are they doing right now? I mean, it sounds like we're getting close, but you know what? Sometimes you can't get to that finish line. You know how difficult that can be. I'm just wondering what kind of stops they're pulling right now. You know anything that you can share with our listeners?
What I will tell you is they're not pulling any punches, that's for sure. I mean, they're doing everything in their power to kill this bill. There are some things in it that they're not necessarily objecting to, but that being said, the priority for them is to get rid of the Rail Safety Act. The railroads like the freedom to run their businesses however they see fit, and they don't see the need for any external oversight, like regulations provide or laws. You know, to them, they're pesky. And so they're making the argument. I mean, just like the two-person crew and the data, they're constantly saying that there's no data, or they're trying to use science as their backup to why there should not be a Rail Safety Act. And in reality, what they're really saying is just trust us with this. We're going to do what we need to do. And they're making the argument that you hear all the time. Why would we not want what is safest, because, you know, that is what makes us the most money? But that's not a true statement. Yeah. You know, when you look at a railroad industry that is so big and can make money so quickly, that it's not about safety. It's about making money. I mean, they make money despite themselves. And that's the unfortunate reality of the railroad industry. So the interest isn't really in preventing the accidents. Is it cheaper to make all these changes to prevent it, or is it cheaper to clean it up? And if you look at Norfolk Southern, if you look at East Palestine, you look what Chairwoman Jennifer Homedy of the NTSB just said, you know, blowing up those cars didn't have to happen. And that, that increased the risk for all of those citizens across East Palestine immensely. You know, what their future looks like is in question. I mean, what their future health looks like is in question. And it's because the railroad chose to take the fastest, easiest course, and that's blowing those cars up. And it just, it's not about safety. It's about the bottom line. And, you know, anytime you find yourself at the table and you say, what is the safest way to do this, and how does it affect my bottom line? When you have that second conjunction of that sentence, that's a problem, and it should never be present.
Well, it's clear they don't care about the workers, and on top of that, they don't care about the communities that the trains go through, and you know, that's evidence of that. So you you indicated that we're close here in the Senate, and we'll see what happens. But you know this, Mr. Cassidy, we still have the House. What are you hearing on that side of the fence right now?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask that. The House is a different beast. The Senate, we're in a good place. I actually believe we have the 60 votes. I do think it'll pass. That being said, we get to the House. The irony in the House is that we have the votes, but we don't have the leadership. And therein is the rub. You know, you've got to have the speaker who's on board to introduce the bill or to allow the bill to be introduced. We don't have the speaker as being supportive. The chairperson of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, which is the committee that will ultimately introduce the bill, has got to be on board to allow it. And Sam Graves of Missouri, unfortunately, is not on board with the bill. And then the chairperson of the House T&I Rail and Pipeline Subcommittee has to be on board. Chairman Nils, we're still working with and having very good conversations with. I just don't know that he's there yet. But all of that to be said, when it comes to the House, Mike Johnson and Sam Graves are the biggest hurdles and are most likely going to be the reason that this bill doesn't become law. And it's, you know, once again, I'll say it, elections have consequences, and you see it in those two people.
Well, you certainly have your hands full. Jared Cassidy joining us on our live line today, serving as the alternate national legislative director for the Smart Transportation Division. The SMART stands for Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transit, comprised of approximately 125,000 active and retired members who work in a variety of crafts in the transportation industry. And he also serves as chief of safety. And we all know that safety is paramount. Mr. Cassidy, I know you are a very busy guy. Thank you so much for joining us here on America's Workforce. Keep us posted on anything that we could do on our end. Okay, sir?
Yes, sir. And again, thank you for having me.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, labor lawyer Andrew Strom will be joining us.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as healthcare and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Attention members of the Heat and Frost Insulators Union who are interested in traveling. Central Ohio has more construction projects on the books than anywhere in the U.S. Mega projects, large and medium-sized jobs are creating more work than our local 50 brothers and sisters can handle. Projects like Intel, the Honda LG battery plant, and multiple data centers for Facebook, Google, and Amazon offer union wages, overtime, and exciting incentives. Local 50 is seeking union travelers to meet the needs of its signatory contractors who can put you to work immediately. If you're a member in good standing and interested in the work opportunities in Central Ohio, visit insulators50.com/AWF travel. For more information, America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the Iron Workers. You can find more at ironworkers.org.
America's Workforce appreciates our sponsor, the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council, who represents more than 18,000 workers from 19 affiliated local unions and district councils.
This portion of the show is brought to you by Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield, labor's trusted health partner, bringing people, communities, and care together to transform the future of health. For more information, please visit anthem.com/labor and trust. This segment of the show is brought to you by the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees Division of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. For more information, please visit bmwe.org.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the United Auto Workers. Find more at uaw.org.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook or follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. That would be AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the United Labor Agency. Before we go to Andrew Strom, I just want to thank so many of you who checked out our show on Monday. Monday, we featured Kim Kelly, who is just a fireball. She's author of the book Fight Like Hell, which is now in paperback. And we got a lot of reaction to that show. I think that's almost the show of the week here so far, until we get to Andrew Strom here, because I'm sure he's going to give us a lot of juicy content here. But Kim was talking about her book and also getting involved. I mean, she goes right into the belly of the beast. She went to Warrior Met, talked to the coal miners, and that's what kind of person and that's what kind of writer she is. So do check that out if you missed it. It was on Monday. That was Eclipse Day. So I know a lot of people were looking up, especially so many people saw that and are still talking about it, especially here in Northern Ohio. AWFpodcast.com. That was Monday's show. Right now, let's go to New York City. Welcome back to the show, Andrew Strom. Now, he is one of the bloggers for On Labor. Do check him out, onlabor.org. Today, we got two stories we're going to get into. Number one involving the Supreme Court. They're about to hear arguments in a case called Starbucks versus McKinney. Andrew, I know you've been following this. Talk to me all about it. What's going to happen here? In this court, I'm kind of nervous already.
Well, you should be. When it comes to worker issues at the courts, I hate to say it, but you can usually predict the outcome in advance.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not going to be a good one. So the issue in this case is, under the National Labor Relations Act, one of the many problems that people have identified with the act over the years is just how slow it is to get justice, right? That it's a very, drawn out process. So this is workers that say, in this particular case, seven workers at a Starbucks were fired all at once in January 2022. And the process at the National Labor Relations Board is the case is investigated at a regional office. And actually, in this case, they move pretty quickly. But usually it takes, 3 or 4 months of investigation. And then the regional office decides whether there's enough merit there to issue a complaint against the employer. They do that. Then they schedule a hearing before an administrative law judge. It takes a couple of months to schedule that hearing. The hearing takes place. Then after the hearing, which is like a multi-day trial, there's both sides write briefs. And then the judge issues a decision. So by that time the judge issues the decision, it's usually a year has passed since workers were fired. Then the employer loses. The employer appeals to the full board in Washington. Then it usually takes another 2 years for the board to issue their decision. And then that's not even the last word. Then after that, if the board rules against them, the employer appeals again. And it goes to a court of appeals, one of the 12 courts of appeals around the country, and that takes another 2 years. So you're talking about basically 5 years from start to finish, and 5 years when, union activists aren't in the shop, or 5 years when an employer, some of the other reasons why, workers would want to get a preliminary. So the law, the National Labor Relations Act, has a provision that says while all this is pending, the board has permission to go to court to seek a preliminary injunction. And a preliminary injunction, what that does is it just is a way of the court saying, wait a minute, you don't get to, you have to turn the clock back to before you did whatever it is you did. Because there's no particular reason why, you know, an employer gets to just do something and then wait 5 years for it to be undone. And a lot of times you can't undo it in 5 years, right? Like, let's say that it's a plant closing. You know, 5 years later, you know, you can win, and the employer will say, well, it's too impractical for us to reopen, you know, the facility that we closed, right? Let's say if they close one of these Starbucks stores, you know, you can't just reopen the same store 5 years later. Right. You know, if in this case, 7 workers are fired, you know, people scatter to the winds in 5 years. They're not going to sit around and wait to be reinstated. But also, you know, in all these cases, there's so much harm that goes on while you're waiting the 5 years, right? The workers aren't able to bargain. And, the other problem, I think I've talked about this before, and we should talk about it another time, is just the lack of remedies at the NLRB, you know, at the NLRB. So if an employer refuses to bargain for 2 years, the remedy for that is just an order to bargain going forward. So the workers never get compensated for that 2 years. And this preliminary injunction is a remedy that, unfortunately, the board uses, far too infrequently. Each year, about 20,000 charges are filed with the NLRB, and you know, some of them are thrown out because you know they lack merit, right? So that takes care of maybe 12,000 of them. You get another 8,000, so that's like leaves you down to 8,000. You know, most cases settle. Most cases settle. The reason why most cases settle is because the remedy, again, is, you know, they have to post a notice. You know, so the employer's like, okay, I'll post a notice. But the cases that don't settle, you know, are the ones that I was talking about that take 5 years to get justice. So of the, you know, 8,000 cases that have merit in a year, in 2023, the board sought preliminary injunctions in 14 of them. And the high water mark in over the last 10 years, they sought 38. So it's not something, you know, where the board is kind of, you know, willy-nilly rushing into court every time, you know, workers, you know, make a, you know, an accusation against the boss that they're, you know, rushing into court to get these injunctions. It's something where, you know, I mean, I've been on the side of, you know, wanting an injunction, and it's very difficult to get the board to act. And they only do it, you know, in the most egregious cases. But nevertheless, you know, I read the employer's briefs in this case, and, you know, cases get to the Supreme Court, and so there's a whole apparatus of, you know, corporate interests that come out of the closet. And, you know, and so there's like, you know, 6 or 7 briefs on the other side, you know, supporting Starbucks, as though Starbucks doesn't have enough, you know, firepower on its own. And, you know, and saying, you know, and I've been saying to people, you know, they're describing an agency, the National Labor Relations Board, that, you know, in my 30 years of practice, I don't recognize. You know, it's like, oh, it's such a powerful agency, and you have to, you know, they have all of these different ways, you know, you have to appear before their judges, and, you know, they have all these ways of, you know, forcing employers to settle, and, you know, and everybody, you know, as though employers are actually afraid of this agency, when in my experience, you know, employers couldn't care, you know, they sort of thumb their noses at the agency.
Yeah.
Oh, but, yeah. So, you know, the actual legal issue in this case is a kind of, you know, doesn't sound that, you know, it's hard to kind of wrap your head around, because the debate is whether the court should apply a 4-part test or a 2-part test. But the bottom line is that everyone on the employer side here is saying, you know, that the courts have to make it much harder for the NLRB to get these preliminary injunctions. You know, that the courts need to be doing this sort of careful, you know, searching of the record and making sure, you know, that the, you know, that the case that, you know, that the strength of the case, and this is, you know, remember, this is coming at a preliminary stage, right, where there hasn't been a trial yet. And so the board's position is we need these injunctions to preserve our ability to actually, you know, litigate this case and get a remedy, right? In other words, we want to put things back, sort of unscramble the egg, you know, put things back to where they were before the employer acted so that we can have a, you know, so they don't get to sort of change the playing field and then make everybody live with that for the next 4 years while we wait until we can finally get a court order to undo all the harm.
Well, Andrew, we'll keep our eye on this one. That is Starbucks Corporation versus McKinney. And in a couple of weeks, the Supreme Court is going to hear oral arguments. All right. I want to get your take on what's happening in a number of Republican states. And I know you've done a blog on this on labor.org where they can use economic incentives. And a lot of states get economic incentives. So if they do, then they can't do card check. And we've been doing several shows on this. In fact, we talked to one of our partners in Alabama just a couple of days ago. My question to you is, how can they do this? Isn't there federal labor law that would supersede this?
You would think so. No, I mean, I think the short answer is they can't. I mean, I think one of the questions is whether anyone is going to have standing to challenge it. I mean, one of the things that's happened you know, in the courts is, I mean, it used to be the case that right-wing judges tried to keep people out of court by saying, well, you don't have standing. I mean, one of the things, so what that means is, you know, let's say you're, you know, you're a citizen of the state and you're like, wait a minute, I don't like this law. You don't get to rush into court to challenge every law that you don't like. You only get to rush into court to challenge laws that affect you directly. And so I think that's one of the challenges here is who is going to actually have standing to challenge this law, right? It's not going to be just like any taxpayer who says, I don't like this law. But absolutely. I mean, in 2008, there was a case called Chamber of Commerce versus Brown. And in that case, California had a law that said employers couldn't use public money, state money, to either promote or deter union organizing. And it was designed to say, wait a minute, we don't want, if you're a government contractor, we don't want you spending our money to fight unions. That was California's idea. And the Supreme Court struck it down. They said that interfered with the employer's rights under the National Labor Relations Act. And so, you know, absolutely, we're supposed to have one uniform body of labor law in this country. That's the theory when Congress passed the National Labor Relations Act. So I don't think there's any question that these laws are illegal. I think the only question is whether anyone is going to have standing to challenge them. And then the other part of it is that in some ways they don't even care. I mean, some of this is just about, a visual or optics to say, I mean, if you look at the websites of any of these states, their economic development websites, they just brag about how anti-union they are, right? They say, come to our state. We have the lowest union density. I mean, it's outrageous.
Yeah.
So that's really, it's all about that. It's all about sending a message to employers that say, you know, come here and, you know, if your workers try to organize, you know, our governor will come, you know, campaign against them, which happens.
I know. I know Nikki Haley did that all too well in South Carolina when she was governor. She said, hey, if you have a company that has a union, go to another state. We don't want you here. It's crazy.
Yeah, just I know. I mean, it was driving me crazy when people were talking about what a moderate she was when she was, you know, still running. I was like, that's no moderate.
No, not at all. Andrew, we're going to have to button it up there. Andrew Strom, labor lawyer. Do check out his blogs on labor.org, on labor.org. That'll be it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up on Monday, the IBEW and the exploitation of gig workers in America. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful weekend.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.